Birth of a Conspiracy Against Hitler. After 5.5 years of National Socialism, it was evident to the few Germans who opposed Hitler that only the army possessed the physical strength to overthrow him. The workers, the middle and upper classes, even if they had wanted to, had no means of doing it. They had no organization outside of the Nazi party groups, and they were, of course, unarmed. Though much would later be written about the German resistance movement, it remained from the beginning to the end a small and feeble thing, led, to be sure, by a handful of courageous and decent men, but lacking followers. The very maintenance of its bare existence was, admittedly, difficult in a police state dominated by terror and spying. Moreover, how could a tiny group, or even a large group, had there been one, rise up in revolt against the machine guns, the tanks, the flamethrowers of the SS? In the beginning, what opposition there was to Hitler sprang from among the civilians. The generals, as we have seen, were only too pleased with the system which had shattered the restrictions of the Versailles Treaty and given them the heady and traditional task of building up a great army once again. Ironically, the principal civilians who emerged to lead the opposition had served the Führer in important posts, most of them with an initial enthusiasm for Nazism, which dampened only when it began to dawn on them in 1937 that Hitler was leading Germany toward a war which it was almost sure to lose. One of the earliest of these to see the light was Karl Goerdeler, the mayor of Leipzig, who, first appointed price controller by Brüning, had continued in that job for 3 years under Hitler. A conservative and a monarchist at heart, a devout Protestant, able, energetic, and intelligent, but also indiscreet and headstrong, he broke with the Nazis in 1936 over their anti-Semitism and their frenzied rearmament, and, resigning both his posts, went to work with heart and soul in opposition to Hitler. One of his first acts was to journey to France, England, and the United States in 1937 to discreetly warn of the peril of Nazi Germany. The light came a little later to two other eventual conspirators, Johannes Popitz, Prussian Minister of Finance, and Dr. Schacht. Both had received the Nazi Party's highest decoration, the Golden Badge of Honor, for their services in shaping Germany's economy for war purposes. Both had begun to wake up to what Hitler's real goal was in 1938. Neither of them seems to have been fully trusted by the inner circle of the opposition because of their past and their character. Schacht was too opportunist, and Hassel remarked in his diary that the Reichsbank president had a capacity for talking one way and acting another, an opinion, he says, that was shared by Generals Beck and von Fritsch. Popitz was brilliant but unstable. A fine Greek scholar as well as eminent economist, he, along with General Beck and Hassel, was a member of the Wednesday Club, a group of 16 intellectuals who gathered once a week to discuss philosophy, history, art, science, and literature, and who, as time went on, or ran out, formed one of the centers of the opposition. Ulrich von Hassel became a sort of foreign affairs advisor to the resistance leaders. His dispatches as ambassador in Rome during the Abyssinian War and the Spanish Civil War, as we have seen, had been full of advice to Berlin on how to keep Italy embroiled with France and Britain, and therefore on the side of Germany. Later he came to fear that war with France and Britain would be fatal to Germany, and that even a German alliance with Italy would be too. Far too cultivated to have anything but contempt for the vulgarism of National Socialism, he did not, however, voluntarily give up serving the regime. He was kicked out of the diplomatic service in the big military, political, and foreign office shake-up which Hitler engineered on February 4, 1938. A member of an old Hanover noble family, married to the daughter of Grand Admiral von Tirpitz, the founder of the German Navy, and a gentleman of the old school to his fingertips, Hassel, like so many others of his class, seems to have needed the shock of being cast out by the Nazis before he became much interested in doing anything to bring them down. Once this had happened, this sensitive, intelligent, uneasy man devoted himself to that task, and in the end, as we shall see, sacrificed his life to it, meeting a barbarous end. There were others, lesser known and mostly younger, who had opposed the Nazis from the beginning, and who gradually came together to form various resistance circles. One of the leading intellects of one group was Ewald von Kleist, a gentleman farmer and a descendant of the great poet. He worked closely with Ernst Niekisch, a former social democrat and editor of Widerstand, Resistance, and with Fabian von Schlabrendorf, a young lawyer who was the great-grandson of Queen Victoria's private physician and confidential adviser, Baron von Stockmar. There were former trade union leaders, such as Julius Leber, Jakob Kaiser, and Wilhelm Leuschner. Two Gestapo officials, Arthur Nebe, the head of the criminal police, and Bernd Gesevius, a young career police officer, became valuable aides as the conspiracies developed. The latter became the darling of the American prosecution at Nuremberg and wrote a book which sheds much light on the anti-Hitler plots, though most historians take the book and the author with more than a grain of salt. There were a number of sons of venerable families in Germany, Count Helmut von Moltke, great-grand-nephew of the famous field marshal, who later formed a resistance group of young idealists known as the Kreisau Circle, Count Albrecht Bernstorff, nephew of the German ambassador in Washington during the First World War, Freiherr Karl Ludwig von Gutenberg, editor of a fearless Catholic monthly, and Pastor Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a descendant of eminent Protestant clergymen on both sides of his family, who regarded Hitler as Antichrist, and who believed it a Christian duty to eliminate him. Nearly all of these brave men would persevere until, after being caught and tortured, they were executed by rope or by axe or merely murdered by the SS. For a good long time, this tiny nucleus of civilian resistance had little success in interesting the army in its work. As Field Marshal von Blomberg testified at Nuremberg, before 1938-39, German generals did not oppose Hitler. There was no reason to oppose him, since he produced the results they desired. There was some contact between Goerdeler and General von Hammerstein, but the former commander-in-chief of the German army had been in retirement since 1934 and had little influence among the active generals. Early in the regime, Schlabrendorf had got in touch with Colonel Hans Oster, chief assistant to Admiral Canaris in the Abwehr, the intelligence bureau of OKW, and found him to be not only a staunch anti-Nazi but willing to try to bridge the gulf between the military and civilians. However, it was not until the winter of 1937-38, when the generals were subjected to the successive shocks engendered by Hitler's decision to go to war, his shake-up of the military command, which he himself took over, and his shabby treatment of General von Fritsch, that some of them became aware of the danger to Germany of the Nazi dictator. The resignation of General Beck toward the end of August 1938, as the Czech crisis grew more menacing, provided a further awakening. And though none of his fellow officers followed him into retirement as he had hoped, it immediately became evident that the fallen chief of the general staff was the one person around whom both the recalcitrant generals and the civilian resistance leaders could rally. Both groups respected and trusted him. Another consideration became evident to both of them. To stop Hitler, force would now be necessary, and only the army possessed it. But who in the army could muster it? Not Hammerstein, and not even Beck, since they were in retirement. What was needed, it was realized, was to bring in generals who at the moment had actual command of troops in and around Berlin, and who thus could act effectively on short notice. General Halder, the new chief of the Army General Staff, had no actual forces under his command. General von Brauchitsch had the whole army, but he was not fully trusted. His authority would be useful, but he could be brought in only, the conspirators felt, at the last minute. As it happened, certain key generals who were willing to help were quickly discovered and initiated into the budding conspiracy. Three of them held commands which were vital to the success of the venture. General Erwin von Witzleben, commander of the all-important Wehrkreis III, which comprised Berlin and the surrounding areas. General Count Erich von Brockdorff-Ahlefeld, commander of the Potsdam garrison, which was made up of the 23rd Infantry Division. And General Erich Hübner, who commanded an armored division in Thuringia which could, if necessary, repulse any SS troops attempting to relieve Berlin from Munich. The plan of the conspirators, as it developed toward the end of August, was to seize Hitler as soon as he had issued the final order to attack Czechoslovakia and hail him before one of his own people's courts on the charge that he had tried recklessly to hurl Germany into a European war and was therefore no longer competent to govern. In the meantime, for a short interim, there would be a military dictatorship followed by a provisional government presided over by some eminent civilian. In due course, a conservative democratic government would be formed. There were two considerations on which the success of the coup depended, and which involved the two key conspirators, General Halder and General Beck. The first was timing. Halder had arranged with OKW that he personally be given 48 hours' notice of Hitler's final order to attack Czechoslovakia. This would give him the time to put the plot into execution before the troops could cross the Czech frontier. Thus, he would be able not only to arrest Hitler, but to prevent the fatal step that would lead to war. The second factor was that Beck must be able to convince the generals beforehand and the German people later, during the proposed trial of Hitler, that an attack on Czechoslovakia would bring in Britain and France and thus precipitate a European war, for which Germany was not prepared and which it would certainly lose. This had been the burden of his memoranda all summer, and it was the basis of all that he was now prepared to do: to preserve Germany from a European conflict which he believed would destroy her, by overthrowing Hitler. Alas for Beck and for the future of most of the world, it was Hitler, and not the recently resigned chief of the General Staff, who proved to have the shrewder view of the possibilities of a big war. Beck, a cultivated European with a sense of history, could not conceive that Britain and France would willfully sacrifice their self-interest by not intervening in the case of a German attack on Czechoslovakia. He had a sense of history, but not of contemporary politics. Hitler had. For some time now, he had felt himself reinforced in his judgment that Prime Minister Chamberlain would sacrifice the Czechs rather than go to war, and that, in such a case, France would not fulfill her treaty obligations to Prague. The Wilhelmstrasse had not failed to notice dispatches published in the New York newspapers as far back as May 14th, in which their London correspondents had reported an off-the-record luncheon talk with Chamberlain at Lady Astor's. The British Prime Minister, the journalists reported, had said that neither Britain nor France, nor probably Russia, would come to the aid of Czechoslovakia in the case of a German attack, that the Czech state could not exist in its present form, and that Britain favored, in the interest of peace, turning over the Sudetenland to Germany. Despite angry questions in the House of Commons, the Germans noted, Chamberlain had not denied the veracity of the American dispatches. On June 1st, the Prime Minister had spoken, partly off the record, to British correspondents, and 2 days later the Times had published the first of its leaders which were to help undermine the Czech position. It had urged the Czech government to grant self-determination to the country's minorities, even if it should mean their secession from Czechoslovakia. And for the first time it had suggested plebiscites as a means of determining what the Sudetens and the others desired. A few days later, the German embassy in London informed Berlin that the Times editorial was based on Chamberlain's off-the-record remarks and that it reflected his views. On June 8th, Ambassador von Dirksen told the Wilhelmstrasse that the Chamberlain government would be willing to see the Sudeten areas separated from Czechoslovakia, providing it was done after a plebiscite and not interrupted by forcible measures on the part of Germany. All this must have been pleasing for Hitler to hear. The news from Moscow also was not bad. By the end of June, Friedrich Werner Count von der Schulenburg, the German ambassador to Russia, was advising Berlin that the Soviet Union was hardly likely to march in defense of a bourgeois state, i.e. Czechoslovakia. By August 3rd, Ribbentrop was informing the major German diplomatic missions abroad that there was little fear of intervention over Czechoslovakia by Britain, France, or Russia. It was on that day, August 3rd, that Chamberlain had packed off Lord Runciman to Czechoslovakia on a curious mission to act as a mediator in the Sudeten crisis. I happened to be in Prague the day of his arrival, and after attending his press conference and talking with members of his party, remarked in my diary that Runciman's whole mission smells. Its very announcement in the House of Commons on July 26th had been accompanied by a piece of prevaricating by Chamberlain himself, which must have been unique in the experience of the British Parliament. The Prime Minister had said that he was sending Runciman in response to a request from the government of Czechoslovakia. The truth was that Runciman had been forced down the throat of the Czech government by Chamberlain, but there was an underlying and bigger falsehood. Everyone, including Chamberlain, knew that Runciman's mission to mediate between the Czech government and the Sudeten leaders was impossible and absurd. He knew that Henlein, the Sudeten leader, was not a free agent and could not negotiate, and that the dispute now was between Prague and Berlin. My diary notes for the first evening and subsequent days make it clear that the Czechs knew perfectly well that Runciman had been sent by Chamberlain to pave the way for the handing over of the Sudetenland to Hitler. It was a shabby diplomatic trick. And now the summer of 1938 was almost over. Runciman puttered about in the Sudetenland and in Prague, making ever more friendly gestures to the Sudeten Germans and increasing demands on the Czech government to grant them what they wanted. Hitler, his generals, and his foreign minister were frantically busy. On August 23rd, the Führer entertained aboard the liner Patria in Kiel Bay during naval maneuvers the regent of Hungary, Admiral Horthy, and the members of the Hungarian government. If they wanted to get in on the Czech feast, Hitler told them, they must hurry. "He who wants to sit at the table," he put it, "must at least help in the kitchen." The Italian ambassador, Bernardo Attolico, was also a guest on the ship. But when he pressed Ribbentrop for the date of the German move against Czechoslovakia so that Mussolini could be prepared, the German foreign minister gave an evasive answer. The Germans, it was plain, did not quite trust the discretion of their fascist ally. Of Poland, they were now sure. All through the summer, Ambassador von Moltke in Warsaw was reporting to Berlin that not only would Poland decline to help Czechoslovakia by allowing Russia to send troops and planes through or over her territory, but Colonel Josef Beck, the Polish foreign minister, was casting covetous eyes on a slice of Czech territory, the Teschen area. Beck already was exhibiting that fatal short-sightedness so widely shared in Europe that summer, which in the end would prove more disastrous than he could possibly imagine. At OKW, the High Command of the Armed Forces, and at OKH, the High Command of the Army, there was incessant activity. Final plans were being drawn up to have the armed forces ready for the push-off into Czechoslovakia by October 1st. On August 24th, Colonel Jodl at OKW wrote an urgent memorandum for Hitler, stressing that the fixing of the exact time for the incident which will give Germany provocation for military intervention is most important. The timing of X day, he explained, depended on it. "No advance measures," he went on, "may be taken before X minus one for which there is not an innocent explanation, as otherwise we shall appear to have manufactured the incident. If, for technical reasons, the evening hours should be considered desirable for the incident, then the following day cannot be X day, but it must be the day after that. It is the purpose of these notes to point out what a great interest the Wehrmacht has in the incident, and that it must be informed of the Führer's intention in good time, insofar as the Abwehr section is not also charged with organizing the incident." The expert preparations for the onslaught on Czechoslovakia were obviously in fine shape by the summer's end. But what about the defense of the West, should the French honor their word to the Czechs and attack? On August 26th, Hitler set off for a tour of the western fortifications accompanied by Jodl, Dr. Todt, the engineer in charge of building the West Wall, Himmler, and various party officials. On August 27th, General Wilhelm Adam, a blunt and able Bavarian who was in command of the West, joined the party and in the next couple of days witnessed how intoxicated the Führer became at the triumphal reception he was given by the Rhinelanders. Adam himself was not impressed. In fact, he was alarmed, and on the 29th, in a surprising scene in Hitler's private car, he abruptly demanded to speak with the Führer alone. Not without sneers, according to the general's later report, Hitler dismissed Himmler and his other party cronies. Adam did not waste words. He declared that despite all the fanfare about the West Wall, he could not possibly hold it with the troops at his disposal. Hitler became hysterical and launched into a long harangue about how he had made Germany stronger than Britain and France together. "The man who doesn't hold these fortifications," Hitler shouted, "is a scoundrel." Hitler, according to Jodl's diary, used the word Hundsfott, a stronger word. Telford Taylor, in Sword and Swastika, gives a fuller account based on General Adam's unpublished memoirs. Nevertheless, doubts on this score were rising in the minds of generals other than Adam. On September 3rd, Hitler convoked the chiefs of OKW and OKH, Keitel and Brauchitsch, to the Berghof. Field units, it was agreed, were to be moved into position along the Czech border on September 28th. But OKW must know when X-Day was by noon on September 27th. Hitler was not satisfied with the operational plan for Green and ordered that it be changed in several respects. From the notes of this meeting kept by Major Schmundt, it is clear that Brauchitsch, at least, for Keitel was too much the toady to speak up, again raised the question of how they were going to hold out in the West. Hitler fobbed him off with the assurance that he had given orders for speeding up the Western fortifications. On September 8th, General Heinrich von Stulpnagel saw Jodl, and the latter noted in his diary the general's pessimism regarding the military position in the West. It was becoming clear to both of them that Hitler, his spirits whipped up by the fanaticism of the Nuremberg Party rally, which had just opened, was going ahead with the invasion of Czechoslovakia whether France intervened or not. "I must admit," wrote the usually optimistic Jodl, "that I am worried too." The next day, September 9th, Hitler convoked Keitel, Brauchitsch, and Halder to Nuremberg for a conference which began at 10 p.m., lasted until 4 o'clock the next morning, and, as Keitel later confided to Jodl, who in turn confided it to his diary, was exceedingly stormy. Halder found himself in the ticklish position, for the key man in the plot to overthrow Hitler the moment he gave the word to attack, of having to explain in great detail the general staff's plan for the campaign in Czechoslovakia, and in the uncomfortable position, as it developed, of seeing Hitler tear it to shreds and dress down not only him but Brauchitsch for their timidity and their military incapabilities. Keitel, Jodl noted on the 13th, was terribly shaken by his experience at Nuremberg and by the evidence of defeatism at the top of the German army. Accusations are made to the Führer about the defeatism in the high command of the army. Keitel declares that he will not tolerate any officer in OKW indulging in criticism, unsteady thoughts, and defeatism. The Führer knows that the commander of the army, Brauchitsch, has asked his commanding generals to support him in order to open the Führer's eyes about the adventure which he has resolved to risk. He himself, Brauchitsch, has no more influence with the Führer. Thus, a cold and frosty atmosphere prevailed in Nuremberg, and it is highly unfortunate that the Führer has the whole nation behind him, with the exception of the leading generals of the army. All of this greatly saddened the aspiring young Jodl, who had hitched his star to Hitler. "Only by actions can these generals honorably repair the damage which they have caused through lack of strength of mind and lack of obedience. It is the same problem as in 1914. There is only one example of disobedience in the army, and that is of the generals, and in the end it springs from their arrogance. They can no longer believe and no longer obey because they do not recognize the Führer's genius. Many of them still see in him the corporal of the World War, but not the greatest statesman since Bismarck." In his talk with Jodl on September 8th, General von Stulpnagel, who held the post of Oberquartiermeister I in the Army High Command, and who was in on the Halder conspiracy, had asked for written assurances from OKW that the Army High Command would receive notice of Hitler's order for the attack on Czechoslovakia 5 days in advance. Jodl had answered that because of the uncertainties of the weather, 2 days' notice was all that could be guaranteed. This, however, was enough for the conspirators. But they needed assurances of another kind, whether, after all, they had been right in their assumption that Britain and France would go to war against Germany if Hitler carried out his resolve to attack Czechoslovakia. For this purpose, they had decided to send trustworthy agents to London, not only to find out what the British government intended to do, but, if necessary, to try to influence its decision by informing it that Hitler had decided to attack the Czechs on a certain date in the fall, and that the general staff, which knew the date, opposed it, and was prepared to take the most decisive action to prevent it if Britain stood firm against Hitler to the last. The first such emissary of the plotters, selected by Colonel Oster of the Abwehr, was Ewald von Kleist, who arrived in London on August 18th. Ambassador Henderson in Berlin, who was already anxious to give Hitler whatever he wanted in Czechoslovakia, advised the British Foreign Office that it would be unwise for him, Kleist, to be received in official quarters. According to a German Foreign Office memorandum of August 6th, Henderson, at a private party, had remarked to the Germans present that Great Britain would not think of risking even one sailor or airman for Czechoslovakia, and that any reasonable solution would be agreed to so long as it were not attempted by force. Nevertheless, Sir Robert Van Sittert, chief diplomatic adviser to the Foreign Secretary and one of the leading opponents in London of the appeasement of Hitler, saw Kleist on the afternoon of his arrival, and Winston Churchill, still in the political wilderness in Britain, received him the next day. To both men, who were impressed by their visitor's sobriety and sincerity, Kleist repeated what he had been instructed to tell, stressing that Hitler had set a date for aggression against the Czechs, and that the generals, most of whom opposed him, would act, but that further British appeasement of Hitler would cut the ground from under their feet. If Britain and France would declare publicly that they would not stand idly by while Hitler threw his armies into Czechoslovakia, and if some prominent British statesman would issue a solemn warning to Germany of the consequences of Nazi aggression, then the German generals, for their part, would act to stop Hitler. Churchill gave Kleist a ringing letter to take back to Germany to bolster his colleagues. "I am sure that the crossing of the frontier of Czechoslovakia by German armies or aviation in force will bring about renewal of the World War. I am as certain as I was at the end of July 1914 that England will march with France. Do not, I pray you, be misled upon this point." Kleist returned to Berlin on August 23rd and showed Churchill's letter to Beck, Halder, Hammerstein, Canaris, Oster, and others in the plot. In Nemesis of Power, page 413, Wheeler Bennett writes that, according to private information given him after the war by Fabian von Schlabrendorf, Canaris made two copies of the letter, one for himself and one for Beck, and Kleist hid the original in his country house at Schmensen in Pomerania. It was discovered there by the Gestapo after the July 20, 1944 attempt on Hitler's life and contributed to Kleist's death sentence before a people's court, which was passed and carried out on April 16, 1945. Actually, the contents of Churchill's letter became known to the German authorities much sooner than the conspirators could have imagined. I found it in a German Foreign Office memorandum, which, though undated, is known to have been submitted on September 6, 1938. It is marked, "Extract from a letter of Winston Churchill to a German confidant." Van Sittert took Kleist's warning seriously enough to submit immediately a report on it to both the British Prime Minister and the Foreign Secretary. And though Chamberlain, writing to Lord Halifax, said he was inclined to discount a good deal of what he, Kleist, says, he added, "I don't feel sure that we ought not to do something." What he did was to summon Ambassador Henderson, in the wake of some publicity, to London on August 28th for consultations. He instructed his ambassador in Berlin to do two things: convey a sober warning to Hitler, and secondly, prepare secretly a personal contact between himself and the Führer. According to his own story, Henderson persuaded the Prime Minister to drop the first request. As for the second, Henderson was only too glad to try to carry it out. "I honestly believe," the ambassador had written Lord Halifax from Berlin on July 18th, "the moment has come for Prague to get a real twist of the screw. If Benesch cannot satisfy Henlein, he can satisfy no Sudeten leader. We have got to be disagreeable to the Czechs." It seems inconceivable that even Henderson did not know by this time that Henlein was a mere tool of Hitler, and had been ordered by him to keep increasing his demands to such an extent that Benesch could not possibly satisfy him. This was the first step toward Munich and Hitler's greatest bloodless victory. Ignorant of this turning in Chamberlain's course, the conspirators in Berlin made further attempts to warn the British government. On August 21st, Colonel Oster sent an agent to inform the British military attaché in Berlin of Hitler's intention to invade Czechoslovakia at the end of September. "If by firm action abroad Hitler can be forced at the 11th hour to renounce his present intentions, he will be unable to survive the blow," he told the British. "Similarly, if it comes to war, the immediate intervention by France and England will bring about the downfall of the regime." Sir Neville Henderson dutifully forwarded this warning to London, but described it as clearly biased and largely propaganda. The blinkers on the eyes of the debonair British ambassador seemed to grow larger and thicker as the crisis mounted. General Halder had a feeling that the conspirators were not getting their message through effectively enough to the British. And on September 2nd, he sent his own emissary, a retired army officer, Lieutenant Colonel Hans Böhm-Tettelbach, to London to make contact with the British War Office and military intelligence. Though, according to his own story, the colonel saw several important personages in London, he does not seem to have made much of an impression on them. Finally, the plotters resorted to using the German Foreign Office and the embassy in London in a last desperate effort to induce the British to remain firm. Counselor of the embassy and chargé d'affaires was Theodor Kort, whose younger brother Erich was chief of Ribbentrop's secretariat in the German Foreign Office. The brothers were protégés of Baron von Weizsäcker, the principal state secretary and undoubtedly the brains of the Foreign Office, a man who after the war made a great fuss of his alleged anti-Nazism, but who served Hitler and Ribbentrop well almost to the end. It is clear, however, from captured Foreign Office documents that at this time he opposed aggression against Czechoslovakia on the same grounds as those of the generals, that it would lead to a lost war. With Weizsäcker's connivance and after consultations with Beck, Halder, and Gerdler, it was agreed that Theodor Kort should sound a last warning to Downing Street. As counselor of the embassy, his visits to the British authorities would not be suspect. The information he brought on the evening of September 5th to Sir Horace Wilson, Chamberlain's confidential adviser, seemed so important and urgent that this official spirited him by a back way to Downing Street and the chambers of the British Foreign Secretary. There he bluntly informed Lord Halifax that Hitler was planning to order a general mobilization on September 16th, that the attack on Czechoslovakia had been fixed for October 1st at the latest, that the German army was preparing to strike against Hitler the moment the final order for attack was given, and that it would succeed if Britain and France held firm. Halifax was also warned that Hitler's speech closing the Nuremberg party rally on September 12th would be explosive and might precipitate a showdown over Czechoslovakia, and that that would be the moment for Britain to stand up against the dictator. Kort, too, despite his continuous personal contact with Downing Street and his frankness on this occasion with the Foreign Secretary, did not know what was in the London wind. But he got a good idea, as did everyone else, 2 days later, on September 7th, when the Times of London published a famous leader. It might be worthwhile for the Czechoslovak government to consider whether they should exclude altogether the project, which has found favor in some quarters, of making Czechoslovakia a more homogeneous state by the secession of that fringe of alien populations who are contiguous to the nation with which they are united by race. The advantages to Czechoslovakia of becoming a homogeneous state might conceivably outweigh the obvious disadvantages of losing the Sudeten German district of the borderland. There was no mention in the editorial of the obvious fact that by ceding the Sudetenland to Germany, the Czechs would lose both the natural mountain defenses of Bohemia and their Maginot Line of fortifications, and be henceforth defenseless against Nazi Germany. Though the British Foreign Office was quick to deny that the Times leader represented the views of the government, Kort telegraphed Berlin the next day that it was possible that it derived from a suggestion which reached the Times editorial staff from the Prime Minister's entourage. Possible, indeed. In these crisis-ridden years that have followed World War II, it is difficult to recall the dark and almost unbearable tension that gripped the capitals of Europe as the Nuremberg Party Rally, which had begun on September 6th, approached its climax on September 12th, when Hitler was scheduled to make his closing speech and expected to proclaim to the world his final decision for peace or war with Czechoslovakia. I was in Prague, the focus of the crisis, that week, and it seemed strange that the Czech capital, despite the violence unleashed by the Germans in the Sudetenland, the threats from Berlin, the pressure of the British and French governments to yield, and the fear that they might leave Czechoslovakia in the lurch, was the calmest of all, at least outwardly. On September 5th, President Beneš, realizing that a decisive step on his part was necessary to save the peace, convoked the Sudeten leaders Kunt and Sebakovsky to Hradčin Palace and told them to write out their full demands. Whatever they were, he would accept them. "My God," exclaimed the deputy Sudeten leader Karl Hermann Frank the next day, "they have given us everything." But that was the last thing the Sudeten politicians and their bosses in Berlin wanted. On September 7th, Henlein, on instructions from Germany, broke off all negotiations with the Czech government. A shabby excuse about alleged Czech police excesses at Moravská Ostrava was given. On September 10th, Göring made a bellicose speech at the Nuremberg Party rally. A petty segment of Europe is harassing the human race. This miserable pygmy race, the Czechs, is oppressing a cultured people, and behind it is Moscow and the eternal mask of the Jew devil. But Benesch's broadcast of the same day took no notice of Göring's diatribe. It was a quiet and dignified appeal for calm, goodwill, and mutual trust. Underneath the surface, though, the Czechs were tense. I ran into Dr. Benesch in the hall of the Czech Broadcasting House after his broadcast, and noted that his face was grave and that he seemed to be fully aware of the terrible position he was in. The Wilson Railroad Station and the airport were full of Jews, scrambling desperately to find transportation to safer parts. That weekend, gas masks were distributed to the populace. The word from Paris was that the French government was beginning to panic at the prospect of war, and the London dispatches indicated that Chamberlain was contemplating desperate measures to meet Hitler's demands. At the expense of the Czechs, of course. And so all Europe waited for Hitler's word on September 12th from Nuremberg. Though brutal and bombastic and dripping with venom against the Czech state and especially against the Czech president, the Führer's speech, made to a delirious mass of Nazi fanatics gathered in the huge stadium on the last night of the party rally, was not a declaration of war. He reserved his decision, publicly at least, for, as we know from the captured German documents, he had already set October 1st for the attack across the Czech frontier. He simply demanded that the Czech government give justice to the Sudeten Germans. If it didn't, Germany would have to see to it that it did. The repercussions to Hitler's outburst were considerable. In the Sudetenland, it inspired a revolt, which after 2 days of savage fighting, the Czech government put down by rushing in troops and declaring martial law. Henlein slipped over the border to Germany, proclaiming that the only solution now was the ceding of the Sudeten areas to Germany. This was the solution which, as we have seen, was gaining favor in London. But before it could be furthered, the agreement of France had to be obtained. The day following Hitler's speech, September 13th, the French cabinet sat all day, remaining hopelessly divided on whether it should honor its obligations to Czechoslovakia in case of a German attack, which it believed imminent. That evening, the British ambassador in Paris, Sir Eric Phipps, was fetched from the Opéra Comique for an urgent conference with Prime Minister Daladier. The latter appealed to Chamberlain to try at once to make the best bargain he could with the German dictator. Mr. Chamberlain, it may be surmised, needed little urging. At 11 o'clock that same night, the British Prime Minister got off an urgent message to Hitler. In view of the increasingly critical situation, I propose to come over at once to see you with a view to trying to find a peaceful solution. I propose to come across by air and am ready to start tomorrow. Please indicate earliest time at which you can see me and suggest place of meeting. I should be grateful for a very early reply. 2 hours before, the German chargé d'affaires in London, Theodor Kort, had wired Berlin that Chamberlain's press secretary had informed him that the Prime Minister was prepared to examine far-reaching German proposals, including plebiscite, to take part in carrying them out and to advocate them in public. The surrender that was to culminate in Munich had begun. Chamberlain at Berchtesgaden, September 15, 1938. Good heavens! Ich bin von Himmel gefallen! Hitler exclaimed when he read Chamberlain's message. He was astounded but highly pleased that the man who presided over the destinies of the mighty British Empire should come pleading to him, and flattered that a man who was 69 years old and had never traveled in an airplane before should make the long 7 hours flight to Berchtesgaden at the farthest extremity of Germany. Hitler had not even the grace to suggest a meeting place on the Rhine, which would have shortened the trip by half. Whatever the enthusiasm of the English, who seemed to believe that the Prime Minister was making the long journey to do what Mr. Asquith and Sir Edward Grey had failed to do in 1914, warned Germany that any aggression against a small power would bring not only France but Britain into war against it. Hitler realized, as the confidential German papers and subsequent events make clear, that Chamberlain's action was a godsend to him. Even the severest critics of Chamberlain's foreign policy in the British press and in Parliament warmly applauded the Prime Minister for going to Berchtesgaden. The poet laureate John Masefield composed a poem, a paean of praise, entitled Neville Chamberlain, which was published in The Times September 16th. Already apprised by the German embassy in London that the British leader was prepared to advocate far-reaching German proposals, the Führer felt fairly certain that Chamberlain's visit was a further assurance that, as he had believed all along, Britain and France would not intervene on behalf of Czechoslovakia. The Prime Minister had not been with him more than an hour or so before this estimate of the situation became a certainty. In the beginning, there was a diplomatic skirmish, though Hitler, as was his custom, did most of the talking. Chamberlain had landed at the Munich airport at noon on September 15th, driven in an open car to the railroad station, and there boarded a special train for the 3-hour rail journey to Berchtesgaden. He did not fail to notice train after train of German troops and artillery passing on the opposite track. Hitler did not meet his train at Berchtesgaden, but waited on the top steps of the Berghof to greet his distinguished visitor. It had begun to rain, Dr. Schmidt, the German interpreter, later remembered. The sky darkened and clouds hid the mountains. It was now 4 p.m., and Chamberlain had been on his way since dawn. After tea, Hitler and Chamberlain mounted the steps to Hitler's study on the second floor, the very room where the dictator had received Schuschnigg 7 months before. At the urging of Ambassador Henderson, Ribbentrop was left out of the conversation, an exclusion which so irritated the vain foreign minister that the next day he refused to give Schmidt's notes on the conference to the Prime Minister, a singular but typical discourtesy, and Chamberlain thereafter was forced to rely on his memory of what he and Hitler had said. Hitler began the conversation, as he did his speeches, with a long harangue about all that he had done for the German people, for peace, and for an Anglo-German rapprochement. There was now one problem he was determined to solve one way or another. The 3 million Germans in Czechoslovakia must return to the Reich. Both in his talk with Hitler and in his report to the Commons, Chamberlain, whose knowledge of German history does not appear to have been very wide, accepted this false use of the word return. The Sudeten Germans had belonged to Austria, but never to Germany. He did not wish, as Schmidt's official account puts it, that any doubts should arise as to his absolute determination not to tolerate any longer that a small second-rate country should treat the mighty 1,000-year-old German Reich as something inferior. He was 49 years old, and if Germany were to become involved in a world war over the Czechoslovak question, he wished to lead his country through the crisis in the full strength of manhood. He would, of course, be sorry if a world war should result from this problem. This danger, however, was incapable of making him falter in his determination. He would face any war, even a world war, for this. The rest of the world might do what it liked. He would not yield one single step. Chamberlain, who had scarcely been able to get a word in, was a man of immense patience, but there were limits to it. At this juncture, he interrupted to say, "If the Führer is determined to settle this matter by force without waiting even for a discussion between ourselves, why did he let me come? I have wasted my time." The German dictator was not accustomed to such an interruption. No German at this date would dare to make one. And Chamberlain's retort appears to have had its effect. Hitler calmed down. He thought they could go into the question whether perhaps a peaceful settlement was still possible after all. And then he sprang his proposal. Would Britain agree to a secession of the Sudeten region, or would she not? A secession on the basis of the right of self-determination? The proposal did not shock Chamberlain. Indeed, he expressed satisfaction that they had now got down to the crux of the matter. According to Chamberlain's own account, from memory, he replied that he could not commit himself until he had consulted his cabinet and the French. According to Schmidt's version, taken from his own shorthand notes made while he was interpreting, Chamberlain did say that, but added that he could state personally that he recognized the principle of the detachment of the Sudeten areas. he wished to return to England to report to the government and secure their approval of his personal attitude. From this surrender at Berchtesgaden, all else ensued. That it came as no surprise to the Germans is obvious. At the very moment of the Berchtesgaden meeting, Henlein was penning a secret letter to Hitler from Eger, dated September 15th, just before he fled across the border to Germany. "My Führer, I informed the British, Runciman, delegation yesterday that the basis for further negotiations could only be the achievement of a union with the Reich. It is probable that Chamberlain will propose such a union." The next day, September 16th, the German Foreign Office sent confidential telegrams to its embassies in Washington and several other capitals. Führer told Chamberlain yesterday he was finally resolved to put an end in one way or another to the intolerable conditions in Sudetenland within a very short time. Autonomy for Sudeten Germans is no longer being considered, but only cession of the region to Germany. Chamberlain has indicated personal approval. He is now consulting British cabinet, and is in communication with Paris. Further meeting between Führer and Chamberlain planned for very near future. Toward the end of their conference, Chamberlain had extracted a promise from Hitler that he would take no military action until they had again conferred. In this period, the Prime Minister had great confidence in the Führer's word, remarking privately a day or two later, "In spite of the hardness and ruthlessness I thought I saw in his face, I got the impression that here was a man who could be relied upon when he had given his word." While the British leader was entertaining these comforting illusions, Hitler went ahead with his military and political plans for the invasion of Czechoslovakia. Colonel Jodl, on behalf of OKW, worked out with the propaganda ministry what he described in his diary as joint preparations for refutation of our own violations of international law. It was to be a rough war, at least on the part of the Germans, and Dr. Goebbels's job was to justify Nazi excesses. The plan for his lies was worked out in great detail. On September 17th, Hitler assigned an OKW staff officer to help Henlein, who was now operating from new headquarters at a castle at Dondorf, outside Bayreuth, to organize the Sudeten Free Corps. It was to be armed with Austrian weapons, and its orders from the Führer were to maintain disturbances and clashes with the Czechs. September 18th, the day on which Chamberlain occupied himself with rallying his cabinet and the French to his policy of surrender, was a busy one for Hitler and his generals. The jumping-off schedule for five armies, the 2nd, 8th, 10th, 12th, and 14th, comprising 36 divisions, including three armored, was sent out. Hitler also confirmed the selection of the commanding officers for 10 armies. General Adam, despite his obstreperousness, was left in overall command in the West. Surprisingly, two of the plotters were recalled from retirement and named to lead armies, General Beck, the First Army, and General von Hammerstein, the Fourth Army. Political preparations for the final blow against Czechoslovakia also continued. The captured German Foreign Office documents abound with reports of increasing German pressure on Hungary and Poland to get in on the spoils. Even the Slovaks were brought in to stir up the brew. On September 20th, Henlein urged them to formulate their demands for autonomy more sharply. On the same day, Hitler received Prime Minister Imrédia and Foreign Minister Kanya of Hungary and gave them a dressing down for the hesitancy shown in Budapest. A Foreign Office memorandum gives a lengthy report on the meeting. First of all, the Führer reproached the Hungarian gentleman for the undecided attitude of Hungary. He, the Führer, was determined to settle the Czech question, even at the risk of a world war. He was convinced, however, that neither England nor France would intervene. It was Hungary's last opportunity to join in. If she did not, he would not be in a position to put in a word for Hungarian interests. In his opinion, the best thing would be to destroy Czechoslovakia. He presented two demands to the Hungarians. One, that Hungary should make an immediate demand for a plebiscite in the territories which she claimed, and two, that she should not guarantee any proposed new frontiers for Czechoslovakia. Come what might with Chamberlain, Hitler, as he made clear to the Hungarians, had no intention of allowing even a rump Czechoslovakia to long exist. As to the British Prime Minister, The Führer declared that he would present the German demands to Chamberlain with brutal frankness. In his opinion, action by the army would provide the only satisfactory solution. There was, however, a danger of the Czechs submitting to every demand. It was a danger that was to haunt the dictator in all the subsequent meetings with the unsuspecting British Prime Minister. Egged on by Berlin, the Polish government on September 21st demanded of the Czechs a plebiscite in the Teschen district, where there was a large Polish minority, and moved troops to the frontier of the area. The next day, the Hungarian government followed suit. On that day too, September 22nd, the Sudeten Free Corps, supported by German SS detachments, occupied the Czech frontier towns of Asch and Eger, which jutted into German territory. September 22nd, in fact, was a tense day throughout Europe, for on that morning Chamberlain had again set out for Germany to confer with Hitler. It is now necessary to glance briefly at what the Prime Minister had been up to in London during the interval between his visits to the Führer. On his return to London on the evening of September 16th, Chamberlain called a cabinet meeting to acquaint his ministers with Hitler's demands. Lord Runciman was summoned from Prague to make his recommendations. They were astonishing. Runciman, in his zeal to appease the Germans, went further than Hitler. He advocated transferring the predominantly Sudeten territories to Germany without bothering about a plebiscite. He strongly recommended the stifling of all criticism of Germany and Czechoslovakia by parties or persons through legal measures. He demanded that Czechoslovakia, even though deprived of her mountain barrier and fortifications, and thus left helpless, should nevertheless so remodel her foreign relations as to give assurances to her neighbors that she will in no circumstances attack them or enter into any aggressive action against them arising from obligations to other states. For even Runciman to be concerned at this hour with the danger of aggression from a rump Czech state against Nazi Germany seems incredible, but his fantastic recommendations apparently made a deep impression on the British cabinet and bolstered Chamberlain's intention to meet Hitler's demands. Though the main points of Runciman's recommendations were presented to the cabinet on the evening of September 16th, the report itself was not officially made until the 21st, and not published until the 28th, when events had made it only of academic interest. Wheeler Bennett points out that certain parts of the report give the impression of having been written after September 21st. When Runciman left Prague on the morning of September 16th, no one, not even Hitler or the Sudeten leaders, had gone so far as to suggest that the Sudetenland be turned over to Germany without a plebiscite. Premier Daladier and his foreign minister, Georges Bonnet, arrived in London on September 18th for consultations with the British cabinet. No thought was given to bringing the Czechs in. The British and the French, anxious to avoid war at any cost, lost little time in agreeing on joint proposals which the Czechs would have to accept. All territories inhabited more than 50% by Sudeten Germans must be turned over to Germany to assure the maintenance of peace and the safety of Czechoslovakia's vital interests. In return, Britain and France agreed to join in an international guarantee of the new boundaries against unprovoked aggression. Such a guarantee would supplant the mutual assistance treaties which the Czech state had with France and Russia. This was an easy way out for the French, and led by Bonnet, who, as the course of events would show, was determined to outdo Chamberlain in the appeasement of Hitler, they seized upon it. And then there was the cant. Both the French and British governments, they told the Czechs in a formal note, recognize how great is the sacrifice thus required of the Czechoslovak government in the cause of peace. But because that cause is common both to Europe in general and in particular to Czechoslovakia herself, they have felt it their duty jointly to set forth frankly the conditions essential to secure it. Also, they were in a hurry. The German dictator could not wait. The Prime Minister must resume conversations with Herr Hitler not later than Wednesday, September 22nd, and earlier if possible. We therefore feel we must ask for your reply at the earliest possible moment. And so, at noon on September 19th, the British and French ministers in Prague jointly presented the Anglo-French proposals to the Czech government. They were rejected the next day in a dignified note which explained, prophetically, that to accept them would put Czechoslovakia sooner or later under the complete domination of Germany. After reminding France of her treaty obligations, and also of the consequences to the French position in Europe should the Czechs yield, the reply offered to submit the whole Sudeten question to arbitration under the terms of the German-Czech Treaty of October 16, 1925. It is worth noting that neither the British nor the French government published the text of this Czech note when they later issued the documents justifying their policies which led up to Munich. But the British and French were in no mood to allow such a matter as the sanctity of treaties to interfere with the course they had set. No sooner was the note of rejection received by the Anglo-French envoys in Prague at 5 p.m. on the 20th than the British minister, Sir Basil Newton, warned the Czech foreign minister, Dr. Kamil Krofta, that if the Czech government adhered to it, Britain would disinterest herself in the fate of the country. Monsieur Delacroix, the French minister, associated himself with this statement on behalf of France. In London and Paris, in the meantime, the Czech note was received with ill grace. Chamberlain called a meeting of his inner cabinet, and a telephone link with Paris was set up for conversations with Daladier and Bonnet throughout the evening. It was agreed that both governments should subject Prague to further pressure. The Czechs must be told that if they held out, they could expect no help from France or Britain. By this time, President Beneš realized that he was being deserted by his supposed friends. He made one final effort to rally at least France. Shortly after 8 p.m. on the 20th, he had Dr. Krofta put the vital question to Lacroix. Would France honor her word to Czechoslovakia in case of a German attack, or would she not? And when, at 2:15 on the morning of September 21st, Newton and Lacroix got Beneš out of bed, bade him withdraw his note of rejection, and declared that unless this were done and the Anglo-French proposals were accepted, Czechoslovakia would have to fight Germany alone, the president asked the French minister to put it in writing. Probably he had already given up, but he had an eye on history. The treachery of Bonnet at this juncture is too involved to be related in a history of Germany. Among other things, he contrived to convince the French and British cabinet ministers of the falsehood that the Czech government wanted the French to state they would not fight for Czechoslovakia so that it would have a good excuse for capitulating. For the story, see Wheeler Bennett's Munich, Herbert Ripka, Munich Before and After, Pertinax, The Gravediggers of France. All through the next day, September 21st, Beneš, aching from fatigue, from the lack of sleep, and from the contemplation of treachery and disaster, consulted with his cabinet, party leaders, and the army high command. They had shown courage in the face of enemy threats, but they began to crumble at the desertion of their friends and allies. What about Russia? As it happened, the Soviet foreign commissar, Litvinov, was making a speech that very day at Geneva reiterating that the Soviet Union would stand by its treaty with Czechoslovakia. Beneš called in the Russian minister in Prague, who backed up what his foreign commissar had said. Alas for the Czechs, they realized that the pact with Russia called for the Soviets to come to their aid on condition that France did the same, and France had reneged. Late in the afternoon of September 21st, the Czech government capitulated and accepted the Anglo-French plan. "We had no other choice because we were left alone," a government communique explained bitterly. Privately, Beneš put it more succinctly. "We have been basely betrayed." The next day, the cabinet resigned and General Jan Syrovy, the inspector general of the army, became the head of a new government of national concentration.